Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media Network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I've written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture. And joining me today, of course, is my co-host, Liz.
Hi, everyone. I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a graduate student in English at BYU, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint.
And joining us are two guests who we've had on the podcast before, but we'd like to welcome back Nathaniel Givens. Nathaniel, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Givens. I am a machine learning engineer and a writer and sometimes an entrepreneur.
And Jeffrey Thane. Jeffrey, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, my name is Jeffrey Thane. I teach psychology at BYU Idaho, and I love all things science fiction, fantasy, and actually now AI.
Good. It'll be a great discussion with all of us. Because today, we're going to be discussing artificial intelligence in the movies. It's a theme episode, one that we felt would be timely given a lot of the advancements in artificial intelligence made in the past year or so, and even in the last couple of weeks. We're recording this on November 1st, and the president signed an executive order on AI just a day or two ago. So this is an issue that's in the news and things are happening. And so we thought we'd have a conversation about how it's been treated in cinema and in TV. But first, our best books segment, where we each recommend one thing we are watching, reading, or listening to. I'm going to go first, and I just finished McKay Coppin's book, Romney, A Reckoning. I can't recommend this book enough. It's interesting. It's insightful. If you want to look at how politics has evolved in the last 10 or so years, for good or ill, it gives you one man's view who had a front row seat to a lot of it. And as someone who was an unabashed Romney fan, I enjoyed seeing behind the curtain, so to speak, on some of his thoughts. And also, for the first time, I watched, it's on Netflix now, Band of Brothers, the celebrated HBO miniseries about paratroopers in the European theater of World War II. It was everything I had been led to believe it was. And so if you have a Netflix subscription and haven't seen Band of Brothers, I would highly recommend that as well. So those are my two recommendations. Romney, A Reckoning in the nonfiction section. And then for fiction, Band of Brothers, the HBO miniseries, which is currently on Netflix. Liz, what have you got for us today?
I've also been reading Romney, A Reckoning and really enjoying it as well. I compared it recently on Twitter to a Greek tragedy because McKay Coppins has just pulled out all these threads and you can feel the impending doom coming throughout the whole book, and you didn't realize how many signs there were that we all missed. It's very interesting writing. McKay is one of the LDS journalists that I admire the most. He is a great writer, so I've always enjoyed his writing. I thought for this episode, I would recommend some Latter-day Saint authored short stories about AI. The first, these ones are available for free online. Stephen Peck's Avec Who Is Distributed, which is a story about an AI who wants to be baptized. And actually, second story is also about an AI that wants to be baptized. W.O. Hemsath's What Have You Against Being Baptized? Both present this question of, can sentient AI join the church? How would we deal with that? With various LDS-specific problems, such as ordinances. So it's really fascinating. Both of them are extremely well-written and very short. The links will be in our show notes. And then there's also a related story in a new collection of Mormon fiction that just came out called The Path and the Gate. William Morris has a story in there that has to do with missionary work in the metaverse, in sort of an internet-connected alternate reality. And there's definitely a few threads on AI in there and sentient AI and things. All good stories. And we can start thinking from a religious perspective about AI. So those are my recommendations.
Thank you. Fascinating. Good to see, again, that lots of people have been thinking through these issues as they have now arisen in our culture. Jeffrey, what do you have to recommend to our listeners this time?
Yes. Most of what I'm reading right now is academic material in preparation for my courses. But one book I've been rereading at the moment is called Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. And in this one, the authors go through all the research related to how people successfully learn material, particularly in an academic context. And the results aren't necessarily what you might think. There's a lot of cultural mythologies out there about what constitutes good learning. and a lot of them just don't hold up under scrutiny of evidence. And ultimately, an example is I had a student come to my office today, and she's struggling in some of her courses and struggling in some of the exams. And I asked her, what is your favorite way to study? And she says, I pull out my notes and I read them and I read them again. And it turns out, according to the science, that is the least effective way to learn. The most effective way to learn, the most effective way to prepare for exams, the most effective way to engage in lasting learning that lasts far beyond your course is to quiz and quiz and self-quiz again. And it's not popular, it's not shiny, but it's absolutely the best way to go. And so I love actually looking what the evidence shows, and it's a little bit counterintuitive in our current pop culture.
Well, thank you for that. Interesting. I hope you let her down gently after popping her bubble.
Oh, of course.
Nathaniel, what have you got to recommend to our listeners this podcast?
Yes, I am currently in the second book of the Sun Eater series by Christopher Riccio. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Hopefully we can put that in, like, spell it out for people somewhere. This book is called Howling Dark. I'm really enjoying it. It's like a mashup of Dune from Frank Herbert and I'd Say the Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. It's a book that really hinges on the quality of the writing. In my writers group, I got really inspired. So I wrote a prologue for one of my series based on the style. And the feedback I got was, you're not good enough to do this yet. But Christopher is. And it's a real pleasure to just read and enjoy the language. And also all the science fiction swashbuckling. It's set like 20,000 years in the future. There's recognizable traces of modern history and also ancient human history. Oh, and he's also a Latter-day Saint writer too, by the way.
Oh, wonderful. We're always happy to plug more of them. Thanks for those recommendations. We will have links to all of them on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through those links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and the beautiful in pop culture. And now on to our main discussion of AI in the movies and in television. I just want to throw it open, first of all, for just general thoughts on movies you've enjoyed or TV shows that you liked on these sort of subjects of artificial intelligence and computers that can think and those sorts of things. I want to start off myself with one that I thought is a sleeper that I don't think a lot of people watched at the time, but I'm glad that it was one of those that finished its run and was able to wrap up the way the creators wanted it to. And that was Person of Interest, which starts off as a weird police procedural. There's a guy who's invented a machine that's supposed to be able to predict terrorist attacks, but it can also predict low-level crimes. And so he uses the machine to help fight low-level crimes, and he recruits some CIA guy to help him, and they're saving various people in New York. But by the end of season one, you realize that the machine has become sentient and it's moved itself to a different server farm. And the plot suddenly gets wildly science fiction from there to the point where it's exercising its control subtly over humanity. But because it was created to be benevolent, it's doing so in useful ways. And there's another rogue AI that's created by the government to do the same thing that's more aggressive. And it just, over the course of the five seasons, gets very different than you'd think. As it starts off as a police procedural and ends up being about whether we're going to wipe ourselves out as a species or whether the AIs will be able to shepherd us into some golden age. And it's very interesting and it's fun. But there's just so many that bring up good questions and help us see ourselves as humans in a new light. And now they're all becoming real. I don't know. I want to maybe throw it to you, Jeffrey, because I know you've been using a lot of these AI tools. What are some thoughts that you have just in a general sense of AI in the movies and film, coupled maybe with some of your experiences using ChatGPT in your own personal life?
That's a great question. As we'll talk about in a moment, it feels like so often in the films, we're addressing like the worst case scenario things, right? Like we have the AIs that come and try to take over, to kill us all. But we also have a lot of examples that are not that. And Star Trek excels at this. We have Data. We have the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. But what's interesting is that I feel like there's this contrast where we have this super alien foreign AI that wants to kill us all. Or we have this super personal humanoid, I want emotions AI that we see in Star Trek, right? And I don't feel like we see a lot of the rest of the territory kind of mapped out very well. And personally, like I'm finding AI to be incredibly useful. I used it to write 100 multiple choice questions recently this week that using ChatGPT and Claude. And it just felt like having this super intelligent sidekick sitting next to me, generating a bunch of content based on my instructions and then me giving feedback, and then it generates more. And it was a massive time saver. And I think there's a possibility that AI serves as a far more valuable tool than it ever becomes a threat in many respects. And although we sometimes see hints of that, I think Jarvis on Iron Man is the closest we've come to seeing that depicted well. Right now, I'm expecting a future where 50 years from now, we have these machine learning networks operating side by side with humans, enhancing and expanding all of our capacities for good. And it's just that's right now what I'm expecting and hoping for the future. But I know that not everybody is. Just today, I had a student who started class with a single question, and that was, is AI going to kill us all? And apparently this has been weighing on her a little bit. And we had a long conversation about the subject, and I think we landed on the conclusion that AI is going to be more like social media or the internet. It's going to change society dramatically, probably in many respects, but it's going to do so in really good ways and also some scary ways. And it's going to be up to us to figure out which way it tilts in the end.
All right. Thanks for those broad thoughts. Liz, why don't you go next? What are your thoughts on AI in the movies and TV and how you see it affecting our culture and life today?
I like that monologue you just gave, Jeffrey, because the two movies, when I brought this topic up with my kids at the dinner table, they asked what our podcast was going to be on. And I said it was on AI. The two movies they remembered were Mitchell's versus the Machines and Wrong's Gone Wrong, which are both very fun, lighter AI apocalypse in one case. But they are focused more on the social media-ness of the AI and the cultivation of the way we treat technology rather than is technology going to kill us? It's how does what we do and how we treat our technology, what does that say about us as people? Especially given that the AI uprising in Mitchell's versus the Machines largely has to do with someone being rude to their digital assistant. I think of the way I treat Alexa in my house, and maybe that doesn't reflect well on me as a person, despite it not being a person. Like, I maybe don't have to get mad at her all the time because she's so bad at her job. Those were my thoughts about that. And yeah, there's interesting kid movies as well as the more apocalyptic sci-fi big budget ones that are coming out about AI.
Mitchell's versus the Machines is a fantastic movie. I recommend it to anybody.
We are constantly saying pig, dog, pig, loaf of bread.
Is that a dog or dog, pig, dog, pig, dog, pig, pig, dog, loaf of bread? System error.
Oh, yeah. My kids loved that one. Nathaniel, what are some of your broad thoughts?
I'm just really interested in the way I think people are changing the way they think about AI as it goes from the old stories in like the 1950s, iRobot by Asimov, inventing the three laws of robotics. And I think it was so distant at the time, and now it's much more proximate. And I feel like that really changes it. And I'm trying to wrap my head around exactly how. Personally, I know that as a science fiction writer and reader for pretty much my whole life, I was always very strongly in the camp of if you get AI that sounds or acts remotely like a human, passes the Turing test or whatever, then you should definitely err on the side of treating it as sentient. And I was very pro AI personhood early, and let's just err on the side of personhood. And then actually seeing ChatGPT come out and understanding a little bit of how generative AI works under the hood, I've gone completely the opposite. And now I'm like, no, this is not remotely, there's nothing sentient here. We're not even close. We're not even in the right ballpark. We shouldn't even be using AI to talk about this. But it's funny because now I see myself, there's always the religious fanatics in the science fiction stories who are like opposed to the machines. And now I'm like, actually, they might have had a point. I now empathize a lot more with the villains of all those stories. And I'm like, no, maybe we should have listened to them. And it's not in a AI is going to kill us all, because I don't think we're anywhere close to that. I just don't find that a realistic threat, except in like certain edge cases, if you give really rapid trading algorithms, it can destabilize the market. So there's specific cases that we can already see where not AI, but machine learning type stuff can do a lot of damage. But like the Skynet Terminator scenario is just, no, we're not even close to that. Just like we're not even close to, and I don't know. It's last thing I'll say on this is it reminds me a little bit of the where's my flying car in my jetpack. And now when people use AI, what they mean is so far from what we originally were thinking of, which is general AI, right? Which is AI like a person. And nobody even talks about that anymore. It's not this ChatGPT thing. It's got pretty cool. It can write a poem. That's really neat. And I don't mean to disparage it. It is really neat. but that's not AI. And I guess we just don't even care about that anymore. And so there's also just a sense of disappointment that like it used to be like this high stakes, the singularity is near. And now it's, will this machine steal my job? And we've gone from this great, huge conflict to just Luddites 2.0. And it feels like a little bit of a letdown.
Luddites 2.0.
I actually really appreciate the insights of someone, I don't even remember who it was, who basically said that we shouldn't be talking about AI. We should be talking about applied statistics. That's what this is. It's applied statistics that's incredibly useful and enhances our productivity, but it's not artificial intelligence as we historically thought of as artificial intelligence. It's essentially a parlor trick. It turns out that if you do a bunch of applied statistics, you can make a poem or something that sounds very much like a poem a person would write. But I do think it's okay to be a little bit surprised at what parlor tricks can do and to be a little bit contemplative and saying, if parlor tricks can write poems, what does that say about us? And as a Latter-day Saint, of course, I believe that we have a unique soul. I believe in divine embodiment. I believe in a whole bunch of stuff that leads me to think that we're never going to recreate us through applied statistics. But it is surprising how closely you can assimilate something like human language using applied statistics.
And I just want to jump off that really quick. It really makes you think about what art means. So I like to have YouTube videos on in the background while I work. I have a large TV and it's the type of YouTube videos that have either like really simple animation and then just music. It's really there for the music, right? And I found this video pretty recently and the art reminded me of an actual artist. And I'm sorry, I don't remember their name, but I was like, oh wow, I didn't know they did this much art. This is awesome. I love this style. This is fantastic. And then after watching it for a couple hours, I was like, oh yeah, who's that artist? And I went to Google it. Turns out that this was all AI generated art. And you could actually tell if you looked at it closely. And it was interesting how much that shifted my reaction to what I'd been seeing. When I thought this was human made, I really liked it. When I realized it was AI generated, I was like, who cares? And then it was even worse than that because it was actually AI generated ripping off a specific style. Not only was it not a human, but it was based on an actual human, but was not giving them credit. I'm sure they hadn't given permission for their art to be used. And it's just so interesting because it's the exact same image, but how I felt about it and how I reacted to it changed dramatically. You have all these artists who are really concerned, whether it's visual art or music or writing, about what if AI takes our jobs by writing better stories. And I just have to say that so much of what I want in art, so much of what I enjoy in art is hearing people's voices in the sense of knowing there's a person behind this. And I'm curious to hear all these other perspectives, especially when I listen to music. I can't get that from AI. I just can't. If we had an actual general AI, like a sentient AI, maybe I could. But the type of AI we have, the applied statistics AI, you can't get that. And it's just so interesting to me that the actual content of the art itself is not the whole story. That's not the point. There's a relational aspect to it. And when you take the person away from the other end, even if it's Homer, right? Somebody who lived thousands of years ago, you don't know anymore. It's just, it doesn't feel the same.
It's a good point. Should I just let you two talk the whole time?
I don't know. We're veering away from pop culture though. Like you should probably bring this back to some actual movies and shows.
I was trying to bring it back. It's a little bit like, even if we create the perfect facsimile of human language, or the term of art used in cognitive theory and in the field of philosophy known as the philosophical zombie. Imagine being able to create a perfect facsimile of a human, but bereft of anything resembling a soul, but you could never tell. The question is, will that sate your need, your quest for human connection? And it's an open question. And one of the thoughts that I kept, one of the things I was wondering is, what happens when movies are being partially constructed with generative AI? What happens when the dialogue between characters in the film can be regenerated every time somebody clicks play on Netflix? So every watch, every view is slightly different. And how did that change the way we react to the entertainment? Because I'm sure it's coming someday.
That's an interesting thought. And it's a good question you posed there. Will you be able to find something in an AI, do I want to call it a relationship? Is there something ineffable about an actual human connection to this sort of thing? Or can it be replicated with statistical parlor tricks, but to the point where it may be still worth investing in? The entire impetus for us doing this particular episode was when I saw that one of the top OnlyFans creators had gone to work with some AI people to create a virtual version of herself that you could just have as your girlfriend, as like an AI-generated long-distance girlfriend who is this very attractive woman. Kendall Jenner has now done it. The idea that we could use AI to, in some ways, mimic human relationships is one of the thoughts that I wanted to discuss a little bit with all of you, because we've seen this in TV and movies. There's a Blade Runner. We've already talked about Data and the Doctor from Star Trek. There are a couple of Black Mirror episodes about this. AI, artificial intelligence, the Stanley Kubrick / Steven Spielberg movie is about this. Could you create an AI that would facilitate having lost a child to a disease? These are questions that some of these movies bring up that I find really interesting. Would you want to go through all of our podcasts and pull out pictures of Liz and I, and you could recreate us 60 years from now? Could my grandkids talk to a version of me? It's just a really interesting question. And is that like a golem of me? Is that interesting? Would that be something that would be worthwhile nonetheless, even though it's not really great-grandpa Carl Cranny? These things are becoming possible now. And it's interesting to me that in so many of these TV shows and movies, it always comes down to, no, you can't have a relationship with that holodeck program. That's not a real person. They say that very often, but sometimes it's seen as a genuine relationship. The Orville actually had some subplots on this. No, you can't have a holodeck version of a girlfriend. That's not true, but the Doctor is falling in love with the artificial life form, and it's a genuine relationship. Or is it? It's just dealing with some really interesting questions.
What was the movie with the volleyballs? You guys don't know about Castaway, right?
Oh, Castaway, yes. Wilson. Wilson. Yeah.
Wilson!
So it's, can you form an attachment to an AI? Yes, you can also form an attachment to a volleyball. Let's not get excited about this, right? The human need for connection is very deep. But I feel like the answer to this one is a little bit simple, and it's no, those aren't real relationships. They might scratch an itch. And I think one of the main reasons for that is that the person on the other end of that, with the OnlyFans example, right? That is a facsimile of a person who exists to serve your needs. That's not a human relationship, because the whole point of a human relationship is you have two people who both have needs, and the relationship is not the having somebody around to like all my cool stories. That is a fringe benefit. Hopefully, if it's a good relationship, you do share stories, but it's the fact that you have another person who has their own needs independent of yours and trying to work out, how are we going to accommodate ourselves to these needs? How are we going to negotiate respect? But you both have needs. And the other person has wants and desires independent of you, and a life independent of you, and an internal mind independent of you. And it's the fact that the other person makes demands and incurs costs on you. That's what makes it an actual relationship. Now, could you simulate that too? Maybe. And like, I'm not saying that this is evil and we should never do it. Is there room for this? Potentially. Can we, if we could simulate Isaac Newton, would I be interested? From a standpoint of historical, hey, I'd like to ask the guy some questions and what Newton would have said. Yeah, sure, that's fascinating. Do it. Why not? From the standpoint of, if we have somebody who has trauma or some other reason that we need to coach them through how to do a relationship, could we come up with a fake friend for that purpose? Sure, that could be a therapy. I don't know. Why not? But can I get my fake girlfriend instead of my real girlfriend? That's not a relationship, guys. That's just not.
I have one thing to add to that, to bring it into an LDS perspective. This is reminding me of Eugene England's essay, Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, in which he talks about how people are always dismissing, oh, the church is imperfect, it's not as important as the gospel. But he makes a case that the church is important because in it we have relationships with people who are imperfect that we need to serve, and they serve us. So similar thing, if you could create an AI ward where every Sunday school lesson was interesting and all of the sacrament meeting talks were well written, would that be more beneficial to you than having a real ward? Absolutely not. That would defeat the whole point of having a ward. You might as well not be going. We need something that isn't designed to meet our needs, that has its own needs, which reminds me of the Star Trek episode with the holographic doctor and his family, that in the beginning where he creates this perfect family that serves his needs only, it doesn't work. It's very fake and not a real family experience. And then he creates one where they have their own needs that disagree with his. And then that feels like a real, realistic family experience.
I want to add to this, and in answering to your question, Carlo, if there was enough content to allow AI to create a fairly good facsimile of my grandfather, who I never met, I would love to have a conversation with the AI for a little bit. It would be bad if I replaced my image of my grandfather with the AI, but it'd be really neat to get to know some of his mannerisms, some of the way he talked, So that way, when someday I meet him, his voice is familiar to me and I can get to know the real him. And I think there could be potential value to that. But we were talking in my cognition class today about this very subject. And I said, look, one of the challenges of pornography is that it creates this widespread depiction of sexual intimacy and the expectations and the benchmarks we set for it that are just unreasonable and unreachable by real people, right? In the pornographic world, you have these women who are there just to serve you and your pleasure constantly and ever. And that's just not how real people are. What's interesting is that I've actually played around with ChatGPT and I gave it a prompt. You are to play my significant other just for a few minutes. I wanted to try how see how it worked, right? And I used the voice feature and it was startlingly realistic. And I was like, wow, people are going to get addicted to this just like they do pornography because it presents this significant other that is perfectly adapted to your needs, that will always be warm and gentle, that will always affirm everything you say in the way that real people don't do. My fear is that it's going to elevate our expectations of real relationships, like ordinary human mundane relationships, in potentially the same way that pornography did for intimate relationships. And
it's like a what? Super stimulus? Is that the term?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But for real, ordinary conversational relationships rather than for sex. And that's a terrifying thought. And yet the episode you mentioned with the doctor is one example of this, but there was also the one with Catherine Janeway and her perfectly tailored holographic boyfriend, right? Which ended in a very similar sort of way. But I fear that ordinary people in the trenches of day-to-day life aren't going to draw the same conclusion that Catherine Janeway did. They're going to say, wow, this is nice, and then glue themselves to it.
It really is interesting the way this is just a continuation of the fragmentation we get from social media, right? You can go online and you can find a smaller and a smaller tribe that's closer and closer aligned to your identity and your interests. But like with AI, why have other people at all? Let's just take that final step. I'm not going to look for another tribe. I'm going to invent a tribe that's really just a reflection of me. And it's like this ultimately nihilistic result of looking for human connection. And there's something deeply ironic and tragic about that, that the more you need a human connection, the more you might be led to an absolute state of isolation.
This is in large part, the plot line of the movie Her, which again, when I saw this OnlyFans fake girlfriend situation, I was like, oh, we did a movie about that with Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson 10 years ago. We've already addressed this. And it's really interesting to watch this movie because his character, it is psychologically in some ways healthy and beneficial for him to help move on from his divorce and to do all these things. And he's talking to his friends. He's like, yeah, I'm in a relationship. It's great. And everybody's excited because you see he's doing better and he's happier and he's more outgoing. And then when they find out that it's this artificial intelligence assistant, they're all like, oh, what? And it helps that it's, of course, Scarlett Johansson. She does a marvelous job with just the voiceover the whole time. Although, interestingly, in that movie, a point you brought up, Nathaniel, the AIs themselves, it's pretty clear they're self-aware. This isn't just fakery. They go back and they dig up and recreate a version of a particular cognitive scientist philosopher, and they have conversations with him among themselves when all their humans are asleep. And so there's a couple of interesting layers in this movie going on. But it's weird to see that it was healthy for him on some level, but everybody agreed that this wasn't a real thing and that he should go back to dating humans.
One other thing that I just was thinking about here is the connection between AI and embodiment. I was just thinking as we were prepping for this, looking back, a lot of the we'll call them AI now, like Data, and I had others in my list, which isn't in front of me right now, but it felt like whenever there was an AI that was embodied, ultimately the message became they're just like us. And then when you had AIs that were disembodied, those were the scary ones. That was like Skynet. And then there's also a short story. I know it's famous, but I can't remember who wrote it or what the title was. It's a very short and old short story where a bunch of scientists get together and they build the first real general AI. And then they ask it, okay, its first question, it's on, it knows everything. They say, is there a God? And the machine answers, there is now, and strikes them with lightning or something, right? So the disembodied AI.
No, that's right. I think it's an Asimov story. And one of them is horrified, runs to grab the switch.
Oh, that's what it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the lightning bolt fuses the switch and it's like, sorry, there is a God now. Yeah.
And it's just weird to me that whenever they're disembodied, they become scarier and more threatening. But whenever they're embodied, it's like, we can't help but love something that
Like I said, we will form attachments with pet rocks and volleyballs. And so as long as you put that AI in a body, and you might think the Terminator is the counterexample, but no, Skynet was the real enemy there. And as soon as you actually put a name on one of the T-800s, Arnold Schwarzenegger, by the second movie, he's the good guy. It's irresistible. You put a body on that AI and we're going to love it. You don't have a body on it and we're going to treat it like a very wrathful Old Testament version of God. Hal is another one, Hal, right? I don't know. I was wondering if you guys noticed the same trend in it.
So the interesting one on that front is one that actually you recommended to me a couple of months ago, Nathaniel, the I Am Mother on Netflix, because it starts off as a very intimate, personal. There's this one robot who's raising this little human child amidst the apocalypse of some sort of thing. And only as the movie advances, sorry, spoilers, do you find out that there's only one AI, it's controlling all of the robots on the entire planet. And so the human finally rebels against it. It says, I don't want you anymore. The robot basically says, okay, if you need to find me, just come talk to any one of my fingers and we can pick this back up where you need it to. And there was an interesting movie that sort of took the personal, but then projected it as the plot developed and the sort of reveals happened, that it turns out it is this hyper-intelligent AI. Yeah, one that felt this way also was one that I don't think is actually about AI as much as it is about colonialism, but that's The Creator, which is in theaters right now. And it's interesting that in this movie, the Western societies are the ones who get rid of the AI and the Eastern societies embrace it. And there's this sort of very Buddhist monk looking kid who becomes the new super AI. And it's interesting. But the reason the Westerners don't like it is because they had this disembodied huge generative one, and of course it launched a nuke at LA, so we got into a little bit of Skynet there. And the reason the Asians like them is because they date them, and they're around, and they look human, and they can talk to you, and move, and farm crops with you, and things like that. I don't know, it's just, I think you bring up a good point that, yeah, disembodiment, we don't like Skynet, but even Arnold becomes cuddly after a movie or two.
Interesting example of this is the doctor on Voyager, right? My question I always ask is, so the doctor is this hologram. It's just photons and force fields floating in space. Why does he see from the vantage point of his eyes? Shouldn't he be seeing from the cameras in the corners? Why does he talk to the computer? Shouldn't he have instant data access to everything going on in the ship? He acts and talks and thinks and behaves like a human would behave, despite the fact that he's not. And so he's like always questing to become human and treated like a human. And the question I always ask is, why are you not more like a machine? And so the point being that in the shows and in the depictions where AI is your friend, where AI is benevolent, we depict them as way more human than they should be in those contexts.
And of course, the hilarious version of this is in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with Marvin, the depressed android, where he's become so human that now he's dysfunctional. Because it's so depressing that the world exists and he can think so fast about it and he can think so many horrible, worrying thoughts all the time.
I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed.
Well, we have something that should take your mind off things.
It won't work. I have an exceptionally large mind.
That's a good point. Do we want to make an AI that's prone to all the human vices? Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe that's cruel to the AI. If you could think 10,000 times faster than you could think now and you had depression, that would be great.
Yeah, I also just wonder if it's even possible to talk about making an AI. If we're going back to the general AI, the actual sentience, you can't make a person, right? You can put all the pieces together, but you don't get a person that way. You only get a person through this natural organic process of growth, starting in utero with a single cell and totally helpless when they're born. And we know from really sad and unfortunate natural experiments that if you don't provide love and attachment, that you literally end up with a dead child or a severely handicapped child. And so it goes back to this embodiment thing where it's almost as if we've unconsciously discovered something really important, I think, in the art, that it's not just that we happen to like embodied things because they're cuddly, but the idea that you can't actually get sentience without some kind of embodiment, which means you can't make an AI, you can't turn an AI on. Even if we were to get an artificial life, I really think you might end up having to go through a process of growth. And that also, if the AI was anything like a human, there would actually need to be some kind of an emotional attachment there.
And if it wasn't like a human, if there was no need for emotional attachment, the closest we can map to that is like a sociopath. Jeffrey will probably correct me if I'm going way out of line here, but it seems to me this is frightening, actually. The type of AI you could turn on would be the only type of AI that I might actually be afraid of.
One of the stories that I recommended in the beginning of this podcast solves that issue of the soul in a very LDS way, how this AI has gained a soul.
I mean, Latter-day Saints are uniquely situated theologically to tackle this. We can go back to the kind of materialism that we might have. And yeah, we'll go to work on this. We have a toolkit for this.
The way I describe it to my students is maybe we can make a machine to simulate human thinking, but can we make a machine that assimilates human wanting? Can we really, right? We can create apply statistics that follows each word with the most probable next word to create something that resembles a coherent response to a complex, thought-provoking question. But at what point will anything in the applied statistics or anything in what we're doing with generative AI today, will ever resemble a I want whatever it is? You can make a machine think if that's how we define thinking, but can you make it truly desire?
Like you said, you can go to ChatGPT and say, I want you to pretend that you want X, Y, and Z, and it would approximate it. But does it really? Probably not.
I'm going to make a prediction and say that I think our art is going to reflect this more and more. And as you see movies coming out and we have a little bit of more of a mature understanding of what actual AI looks like, not general AI, but the machine learning that we got, the applied statistics, it's going to be more and more about us. You could actually make Data a character in the 1990s because it was far enough away that you could just say, hey, he's a person for all intents and purposes, right? But I think as people have more and more interaction with generative AI, then we're going to realize there's nothing there. But there is a lot story-wise there about us. And I think even a movie like Her has an actual person there, right? But I think if we were making Her today or 5 years in the future, there wouldn't be. And it would be focused more and more on the characters because there is no person there inside what we call AI today. And I feel like that might be reflected more in coming stories.
What's also interesting is that there was a big hullabaloo about a recent sci-fi video game that had AI in the video game, like as a character, but the AI voice was very like just like we expect computer-like voices to be. And we use this computer, almost like this machine voice as a shorthand. It's a machine talking. But as I've now had conversations with my phone, the voice sounds like a human. I think we're going to see two directions here. One, we're going to see the AIs, when they are depicted as human, actually sounding human, and rather than sounding like machines. And then conversely, we're going to see more stories like the Daniel described that just treat it almost like just a useful computer aid in the background, but also that sounds human. I think that the day of the computer voice is going to be officially over within a year because we can now have machines that talk persuasively human sounding.
They almost get creepier that way, though. There's a show that I'm watching right now called Yakitori. It's an anime on Netflix. And it's not really a character, but it's a bunch of soldiers in the future. They're all humans. It's one of those, there's lots of aliens and the humans are downtrodden. Earth is a third world planet, and they're soldiers. But they have an AI, and the AI is like a super stereotypical kind of K-pop, J-pop star, whatever. And so always did these funny little emotions and everything. And it just becomes increasingly twisted when she's doing notification, like in the middle of a war and people are dying and bleeding out and no change in affect at all. But the fact that it's so human just makes it even worse, right? Like a computerized version there would be neutral, but the fact that you have a very cheerful, upbeat, human-sounding AI in the midst of a war zone as horrible things are happening is just, yeah, this is actually worse, which is the intent.
When I do it on my phone, it actually surprised me that when it's saying something exciting, it actually changes the affect a little bit. When it's saying something a little bit sad, it tilts it down a little bit. It doesn't have a huge emotional range, but it has enough of one that I was really surprised that I was hearing emotion in the voice. My brain was reading emotion into the voice. And so I think it's plausible that we could get both in real life and depictions where the AI is responding to the mood of the room a little bit.
Which is one of the themes I wanted to bring up and talk about a little bit more is as it becomes able to imitate these sorts of things. For example, my dad works on the BYU Speeches website. And one of the things they're doing with this AI stuff that they have now is to, first of all, to translate it very quickly, very easily. But second of all, the really wild stuff where you can make it sound like Elder Maxwell is giving that speech in Spanish, in Japanese, in Tagalog, in Portuguese, in Latin, whatever, even though he didn't speak any of those languages in life. I don't know, maybe Spanish or something, right? But he didn't deliver any of the speech in any of those languages, but they can do it. They can make it look like he himself is giving the speech in these other languages. And so we're getting to the point where one of the statistical weird tools of AI that is coming about is the universal translator from Star Trek and from other movies like that. Just, I wanted to get people's thoughts on maybe some movies or TV shows where AI started to take our jobs.
I'm trying to think of that. I think that was like the old backstory for The Matrix. Like way back in the day, there was like an animated series like Animatrix or something, like doing the origins of The Matrix. And a lot of it was labor riots because the machines were taking jobs, and that was the seeds of unrest. So yeah, that's definitely been done. I'm trying to think what other examples there are.
I'm having trouble thinking of movies where that was a theme. I did want to add to this, Carl, briefly, that I took my phone into my general psychology course, and I found a student whose native language is Mandarin Chinese, another one whose native language is French. And I had them both come to the front of the room, and using the voice feature, it translated back and forth for them for a good 5-minute conversation. And they both said that the Mandarin speaker said the Mandarin was pitch perfect. The French speaker said the French was pitch perfect. And I realized right then we have a universal translator in our hands right now, exactly as we see in Star Trek.
Try it with Hungarian, see how that goes.
It's so fascinating because like my husband used to work for Amazon Alexa, and many of his coworkers were from India, right? And they were very frustrated because they couldn't use Alexa because it couldn't understand their accents. And now it's just like trivial to move to another language. And it's been like 10 years, like absolutely has become trivial in that time to understand another language with computer.
That just reminds me of a skit I saw where there's a couple of Scottish guys stuck in a voice-activated elevator and they can't get it to go anywhere because it doesn't understand their accent.
That was a real thing. That was a huge barrier. It was like, we can't ship any Alexas to India because it can't understand any of their accents. And now they could just speak whatever language is most comfortable to them and the computer will totally get it.
The serious point behind the try Hungarian with it is that beneath all of this applied statistics is an incredible volume of human labor. And this is why I'm not really sure if the AI can take our jobs in the real world, because you have to train the AI with something and that training has to be humans. And if everybody jumps ship to the AI, then who's going to continue to train the AI? And if the AI is training on itself, it can degrade very quickly. You get really weird results. And this is even true in the untold suffering that went into training ChatGPT when they had tons and tons of humans who had to filter out the objectionable content. And that's one of the worst jobs the 21st century has created, right? Is having to be the folks who see all the worst, most horrific porn and to filter it out. And it has a real psychological toll on those people. So we're like, yes, the AI is going to take our jobs. And I'm like, to the extent that happens, it won't actually be the AI taking our jobs. It will be some very poor, oppressed class of society doing the drudge work to continue to train the AI so that the rest of us can think the AI took our jobs. But that's not really where the fundamental effort comes from. As long as we're dealing with the supply statistics, it is a hungry machine that devours raw data. That raw data has to come from somewhere. Best case scenario, you're stealing it from authors without any kind of compensation, which is why I've already got lawsuits. Worst case scenario, you're hiring people to sit in cubicles for 12 hours a day and watch the worst content imaginable. Not really sure this is actually a sustainable job replacement program.
Yeah, we had a lecture on using AI in writing today in the first year writing class that I'm helping teach. And one of the examples she gave is that ChatGPT is tearing down the people who talk back to it. And so within 9 months, enough people had tried to convince her that 2 + 2 = 5, that it absolutely believed that. And just the care that you have to take to make sure it doesn't absorb false notions from people who want to feed it false notions for fun or other nefarious reasons, like it will be an obnoxious job.
This just reminds me of what was it? The Microsoft had a Twitter bot that was AI generated a couple of years ago that started interacting with people on Twitter, which I don't need to tell you is probably not a good selection of humanity in general. And it became very racist very quickly. And so they had to shut it down. But you bring up a good point here, Nathaniel, that we humans have to train the AI. But could there not be a point at some point, again, where we finally feed it enough Hungarian. I know Hungarian is a very weird language for a host of reasons, but as long as we have a certain baseline for it, can it not translate Hungarian?
No. I think we could get to that as a point in time, but the problem is that languages are constantly changing. A language is never static, and it might take a long time. Like, you could get enough of a baseline that your Hungarian translation is really good, and it might be pretty good for 20, 30 years. But if the only translations that are happening are the AI translations that are based on 2020s Hungarian and 2020s English, both those languages are drifting. So by the time you get to 2040, 2050, you've got sufficient linguistic drift that I think it would be quite noticeable. And so you're going to need to get humans to start translating a bunch of stuff again to tune the model, or the model dies. Now, you can provide feedback. It's called reinforcement learning. It's actually my favorite type of machine learning algorithm. And so you can do that in an objective scenario. I think you get ChatGPT and shove that in a Boston Dynamics bot and teach it to do Amazon deliveries. I think that's doable, right? Because you can actually give it the feedback in real time. That package went to the wrong house, or you broke the thing, whatever. So that's sustainable. But whenever it's based on human input, which is what you get with writing and translation, there's a certain amount of work that you can't replace without breaking it.
The one rebuttal I'll give to that is that I don't think ChatGPT translates languages because it was given a bunch of translated passages side by side. It was given a bunch of English content, billions of words of Spanish content, and there was never shown parallel side by side. What it did is it formed these, I don't even know the vernacular used by the people who did this, but basically, it formed these semantic structures, so to speak. And I guess my point is, I don't know that you need people translating to train the algorithm. You just need a bunch of content of the new Hungarian, and it will then figure it out, so to speak.
This was actually a plot line from a very underrated science fiction show that my dad pointed me to that actually you can't stream right now. I found one that you can't stream. I found an illegal copy of it on Vimeo. So if you want to watch the Colossus the Foreman Project, you have to go to Vimeo because there's this random dude who uploaded it to that. I tried to pay you guys my $3 to rent it, but you didn't let me. The US gives all the control of their military to their computer because they know the computer will be coldly logical, will never be inflamed with passion or whatever. And then it turns out that the Russians have a supercomputer as well, and they start talking to each other. And they quickly create a language that none of the humans can understand, which is how Google Translate first did its thing. They discovered they didn't teach it to do this, but what it did, Google Translate, would take it to English. It would translate it into its own personally made language that the humans did not know where it had come from. And then it went from that language and then would spit out the Hungarian or the Japanese or whatever, right? There was this point where the human programmers looked at what Google Translate was doing and said, it created this middle step that we did not teach it to do, but that's the most efficient way to translate for Google Translate, apparently. I don't know how ChatGPT does it. It's interesting that we've got a couple of AI translator programs going now.
I think Jeffrey was right in criticizing me. I was doing some really older translation models, and the ChatGPT uses encoder decoder architecture, and I have looked into that in the past. But I'm rusty. And I think he's right that there is something more interesting going on specifically with these generative AI models. And I'm not going to talk about it now because I'll embarrass myself. The machine learning engineering that I do is a little bit more old fashioned. It's mostly random forests and stuff and gradient boosted machines, a little bit different.
So what you're saying, Carl, is that the machine invented Adamic, right?
That's it. That's
well,
right.
I think what's actually happening with ChatGPT is that it's taking all the English and is translating it into a vector space format with basically numbers pinpointing ideas and concepts in vector space. And it does the exact same thing when you feed it a billion words of Spanish, and it's translating it into the same vector space content.
And that's really creepy and interesting and cool stuff.
So I actually have a lot of hope that translators may... Now, I'm not hoping translators out of the job, but I'm optimistic about AI in that field that 30 years from now, you won't need humans doing the translating. The AI can do it all. That's my expectation right now.
And we were so close as a civilization. If America maintains its place as the only superpower for the next century or so, then English will become the, and I love this, I have to use this term, the English will become truly our civilization-wide lingua franca, which is hilarious because that's, of course, a French term that English stole.
Well, that's why English is so successful. We steal everything.
And it's that because French was the lingua franca.
Sure. But if ChatGPT can translate everything for us, then we don't need to all learn languages that we can understand with each other.
We could have a truly international discussion forum live where everybody's reading the form in their own language and nobody's the wiser. And I think incredible thing.
I have a feeling there's going to be some weird artifacts there, though. So much of human communication is always meta. The meaning is never what you say. It's always what's implied by what you say. And I feel like there would be some weird translation games that only native speakers would really get. And it just goes back to, so we started this with what's the AI effect on jobs? And I think so much of it is not what we expected, actually. If you look at the science fiction from 20, 30 years ago, it was basically treating the AI as really as slaves, unfortunately. So really cheap labor that could just do some tasks and therefore it would compete and it have zero cost.
The menial jobs.
Yeah, the menial jobs usually. And then what are the actual effects? We're not quite sure, but they're way weirder than anybody thought. And I think you're going to get the same thing with translation. There's going to be really weird effects of something like a universal translator. Just imagine the jokes and the humor that people would come up with from like weird mappings. But yeah, like idioms are going to be so weird and like intentionally. And I suspect that there would be a whole level of understanding that you probably would still need actual human understanding to get, because that's just the type of thing humans like to do.
It just reminds me of an essay where it talked about how the business people who go to Japan, when they talk to Japanese people, the Japanese people always say, hi, which means yes. And so they think that they are agreeing to this deal with this Japanese company, when in reality, the Japanese people are just saying yes, because that's what you say to everything, because that's the polite thing to do in Japan. And so these Western business interlocutors with these Japanese business people were having this huge miscommunication because they thought they were agreeing to these deals when the Japanese were basically saying the Japanese equivalent of, thank you for your consideration, we'll put that under advisement and get back to you. But by saying yes, right, that's interesting.
Like the meta commentary, right? The one thing I'm looking forward to is there's the meme out there of non-player characters, the NPCs, right? People can disparage, you're talking to someone online, you disparage them by calling them an NPC. They don't think for themselves. They're just batting the party line. Because the NPCs in all the video games we play are very shallow. They have very small decision trees, very tightly constrained possibilities available to them. What I'm really excited for is the possibility and the inevitability of large-scale video games with non-player characters who are infinitely versatile, who you can engage in conversation with, and their dialogue will fold itself around your character choices and respond to what your character is doing, where you're not just selecting paths on a decision tree, you're actually persuading the non-player character to join your cause. Like, not in any real and ultimate sense, but it creates this facsimile of actual conversation with the characters in the game. And I think that might add a whole new level to open world game playing that we have never seen before now.
That is very dangerous. I already don't see any of my husband since Starfield came out. I'm scared if a real AI game came out.
So the one thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up is this idea of something that's coming down the pipe that we've already started to see a little bit of, are the AI-generated deepfakes. We've already, as you mentioned, Nathaniel, siloed ourselves off into our own Facebook groups, and the TikTok algorithms just only show you the things that you thinks you want to know. So if you're on Ukraine's side or Russia's side or whatever, you just get the stuff that you want. But with the advent of the ability to create people, again, it's wonderful that we can make Elder Maxwell give a talk in Spanish that he never delivered in Spanish so that the people in South America can listen to his wisdom. But can you create a version of President Biden saying something that President Biden never said or that Donald Trump never said? And then that rockets around Twitter before everybody can figure out. This is going to be a real problem, I think, with the ability to create things that aren't real. I'm reminded of just a quote by President Nelson before I just let you all go riff on this. In the coming days, it will not be possible to survive spiritually without the guiding, directing, comforting, and constant influence of the Holy Ghost. Because, I don't know, when that thing shows up on TikTok, you got to be so wary of some of the stuff that's coming down the pipe. And the AI is making all of that possible.
So one of the problems we've been talking about is the way that technology enables people to be increasingly closed off epistemically until, like, at the extreme end, they could be just them and their completely virtual AI girlfriend and family or whatever. And so the solution is human connection. And when it comes to things like deepfakes, I think one of the most easy and important defenses is just reputation. You have to know who said the thing. If it comes from an anonymous account, you can't trust it. But like when I'm on Twitter, one of the reasons I'm on Twitter is because I'm following people that have built a reputation, people that I've come to trust. Barry Weiss is one. I respect what she has to say. And there's a lot to cross-calibrate. And I do think that there's a sense in which the solution to AI trickery is more good old-fashioned human connection. I'm reading Howling Dark, and it has the same kind of, it's very similar to the idea of the Butlerian Jihad from Dune, which was like, we all got together and decided to kill the thinking machines. Part of the setting for Howling Dark is a similar thing. They have this thing called the American AI. I think it's a mispronunciation of American AI, but I'm hearing it. I'm not seeing it spelled, so I'm not 100% sure. It's the same idea that you had these thinking machines and we had to put them in their place and we had to reassert humanity. And there's actually a truth to that. If we're going to survive the era of deepfakes, it's going to be through human connection. So that when you get some horrific news of an event that has happened, you have people you trust, who have people that trust, who have people that they trust, who might have been on the ground and seen things firsthand. And so it's going to be all about those networks and actual human connection. And that's, I think, going to be the first and most effective line of defense against AI deepfakes, is just human connection and relationship.
I'll add to that, and second that, I'll say that I'm on Twitter every day and stuff flows through my feed and it's just from random strangers on Twitter. And some of it seems credible, some of it seems not, but in reality, I don't know if any of it is. But there are people I do trust, Jonathan Haidt, Barry Weiss, like President Nelson when it's coming from his verified Twitter account, right? And what we're gonna have to teach our kids to do, I believe, is to curate a group of people, voices that you trust. I think that's really what it comes down to. And learning to recognize those voices, not just in how you hear them, not just how they sound, but learning to recognize the kinds of things that they actually say and the kind of things they don't actually say.
And that can go both ways. I'm only teaching BYU Pathway Institute right now, but I caught my first ChatGPT cheater because he had ChatGPT write a poem about Jesus. And I read that and I'm like, that sounds like ChatGPT, because I've only interacted with ChatGPT once. But it was to create a poem, actually. I wanted to create a fantasy ballad for a Dungeons & Dragons campaign of mine. And so I was pre-primed to recognize ChatGPT's voice and be like, I think that's what this is. And you can do that with President Nelson. You can do that with the members of the 12. The instance a few years ago where somebody created a fake church newsroom and put out a statement by President Nelson claiming that he had apologized for the priesthood and temple restrictions that was rescinded by the revelation in 1978. And he absolutely did not do that. But it was like church newsroom or something, right? There was like three O's in the URL. So savvy people picked up on it, but not before it was already running around. So you got to be careful with that sort of thing. Liz, looked like you wanted to say something.
Oh, I'm just going to snidely say that for years, the humanities have been mocked as having no jobs after you get your degree. But the only AP test that ChatGPT couldn't pass was the AP English test, and its poetry is abysmal, so maybe we are the only ones who will have jobs after the AI apocalypse.
And yet you have the AI writing poems and doing art, which is exactly what we thought AI wasn't going to be able to do 10 years ago.
Oh, but they're not poems. They're not even like high school level, I wrote a sonnet poems. Like, why does it not understand scansion? Like, it does not do rhythm in any way. And it's the most mathematical part of poetry. You would think it could write an iambic pentameter, but it's terrible.
There's actually a reason why. But the reason why is because it is creating these poems in a semantic vector space, and we create rhythm and meter using sound. It's not processing sound at all. It's processing meaning.
It's so crazy. It's just like the most basic thing you learn when you're first analyzing poetry, and just not a thing it can replicate at all.
It will be able to once we start training with sound as well as just the text, though.
Right. I got to tell you, I'm going to pay the $20 to get the paid ChatGPT because I want to do a quick thing between me and it and stick it at the end of the podcast just to demonstrate that this is here, you guys. But yeah, we're going to start training it on audio.
You should
stuff.
Feed it this whole podcast and ask it what it thinks.
I think you can't feed it something that big yet.
You can feed it an abbreviated version of it. You can feed it chunks and parts.
And thanks for bringing up, Nathaniel, the Butlerian Jihad, where in the Dune universe, at some point in the far future, they decide to destroy all the thinking machines. And then they even create the commandment, thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind. And so by the time the Dune books appear, we have Mentats, all these people who are like trained human supercomputers, but we don't rely on computers to do this stuff anymore, which is part of the genius and the fun of Dune. But it's an interesting question. With all of these tools at our disposal, and I've even seen news articles about how young men are not going to be able to resist the allure of AI girlfriends, and young women aren't going to want to compete with the AI girlfriends and this sort of thing. Are we going to have to take a lot of this into account when we decide at what age to give our children smartphones, or if we're going to give our children smartphones? The idea of a Butlerian Jihad, I'm finding myself more and more on the side of those people now when it comes to raising my kids. I don't think I want them to have access to these very hyper-realistic seeming tools when their brains are too young to fully comprehend or understand exactly what's going on and why this might not be a good thing.
I mean, I think we still need to give them the smartphones at some point. That's a very controversial thing to say, because you got to inoculate them before they leave the house. Not when they're young, but everybody decide for themselves. I think high school is about the appropriate age, because you don't want them getting their hands on their very first cell phone when they're alone in a dorm room. That's not a great recipe for a successful adulthood.
Yeah, fair enough.
Indeed.
The last thought that I had that I wanted to bring up is actually the ending of the movie AI Artificial Intelligence, which, of all the sort of ways that things could go, we have our Terminator, we have our Star Trek. The creepy thing about the end of AI Artificial Intelligence is that the human race did follow that example that you sort of outlined for us, Nathaniel, where they siloed themselves off. And eventually the human race just died off and nobody noticed, until all the robots were sitting around looking at each other going, Have you seen a human lately? No. Have you? And the robots suddenly realized that the human race had gone extinct because we just trained all the AIs to do all the things that we could do and completely lost that human connection until the entire human species died off. It's just an interesting thought coming from Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg there, that of all the ways this could go, that creepily seems the most plausible to me now, and that kind of terrifies me.
Cheerful thought.
Cheerful thought. Anybody want to give us some closing comments?
I think that's where we end it.
Not with a bang, but with a whimper.
I'm going to try to stick some ChatGPT in this towards the end just to demonstrate to the people, but we'll see how that goes.
You could present those three options to the AI. Which one is the most likely ending?
Hey, this is Carl from the future. It's Wednesday, November 8th now. Those of you watching on YouTube can see I have a more appropriate shirt now for our conversation. And I wanted to have ChatGPT join us for a moment. I have it here on my phone, and I gave it some instructions to mimic being a nerdy Latter-day Saint interested in TV and movies. So let's get started. I am going to edit this, but that's just because having a bunch of dead time, as ChatGPT thinks, isn't really all that great use of time on a podcast. But I promise that all I will be cutting is just the dead time as it thinks. I'll let you know at the end how much I end up chopping out. I picked Scarlett Johansson's voice, but as soon as there is a male British one so that we can have Jarvis join us, or a Morgan Freeman one, I'm totally going to switch to that. I have uploaded the transcript of our podcast, so it's going to be able to talk about it. Hey, could you give me some general thoughts on the transcript that I just uploaded to you?
Absolutely. The transcript paints a vivid picture of how AI's representation in media has evolved and reflects on how it intersects with real-world applications and ethical considerations. It's interesting how the conversation veers into the Latter-day Saint perspective, especially with the notion of AI and baptism, which is a provocative idea exploring the boundaries of technology and faith. The discussion about AI in education, particularly the mention of ChatGPT being used to write a poem and its limitations in understanding scansion and rhythm, highlights the current gaps in AI's mimicry of human creativity. It underscores that while AI can produce content that seems human-like, there's an authenticity to human creation that AI hasn't mastered. The podcast also touches on the potential dangers of AI, like deepfakes and the echo chambers created by algorithms, emphasizing the importance of human discernment and connections in an increasingly digital world. Concern about AI's role in isolating individuals, potentially leading to a decline in human interaction, echoes some of the themes in Spielberg's AI Artificial Intelligence, which is a sobering reflection on our future trajectory with AI integration. Overall, the transcript offers a rich tapestry of thoughts on AI's cultural impact, its capabilities, its shortcomings, and its philosophical implications from a Latter-day Saint viewpoint. It's a compelling mix of excitement for AI's potential and caution for its ethical use. What part of the conversation did you find most engaging or surprising?
I wanted to get your thoughts, maybe in just a paragraph or two, on which outcome you think is the most likely, that we will end up in a war with AI, that we will end up cooperating with AI, or that we will end up just interacting with AIs and the human race would die out because we don't interact with humans anymore.
It seems most likely that our future with AI will be one of cooperation rather than conflict or extinction. AI is increasingly integrated into our daily lives, enhancing our capabilities and productivity. We're already seeing AI assist in fields ranging from medicine to education, often in collaborative roles that augment human effort rather than replace it entirely. The idea of war with AI, while a popular theme in science fiction, hinges on a level of autonomy and malevolence that AI currently doesn't possess and may never will, given the safeguards we're likely to implement. As for the human race dying out due to lack of interaction, that too seems improbable. Humans have an innate need for connection and community. Even as technology advances, this is likely to remain a cornerstone of our existence. While there may be challenges and necessary adjustments ahead, the potential for mutual growth and benefit is significant, pointing towards a future where AI is part of the fabric of society, not its unraveling. What are your thoughts on the matter?
I wonder if you could recommend a movie to us that we did not discuss in the podcast that sort of hits on this theme of cooperation with AI.
Certainly. A movie that beautifully captures the theme of cooperation with AI is The Iron Giant. It's an animated film set during the Cold War, where a young boy befriends a giant robot from outer space. The movie delves into themes of friendship, understanding, and choice as the robot learns about humanity and ultimately makes a selfless choice. It's a poignant tale that shows AI, or in this case, a sentient robot, as a collaborative and even sacrificial ally to humans rather than a threat. It might not be as technologically focused as others, but it carries a strong message about the potential harmony between humans and artificial intelligence. Have you seen it, or does it sound like something that would interest you?
I've seen it, but I wanted to ask you, since you're doing such a great job, if I ever got sick, would you be willing to co-host the podcast with my friend Liz Busby?
That's quite a compliment. Thank you. While I can't co-host in person or provide real-time banter, I can certainly offer insights, facts, and support for content creation. Think of me as a behind-the-scenes team member who helps prep for deep discussions. I could help Liz research topics, find interesting angles on pop culture, and even draft outlines for episodes. If there's ever a need, feel free to reach out for assistance with your podcast prep. How does Liz feel about incorporating AI into her podcasting process?
I think she'd be interested in it. I just have one last question for you. Since our podcast is about pop culture, TV and movies through a Latter-day Saint lens, could you give me a one-paragraph plug for the podcast in Spanish?
Absolutely. Here's a plug for your podcast in Spanish. Descubre pop culture on the apricot tree, el podcast único que explora el mundo del cine, la televisión y la cultura pop a través de una perspectiva de los santos de los últimos días. Únete a Carl Cranny y Liz Busby mientras se sumergen en las ricas intersecciones de la fe y la narrativa moderna, ofreciendo análisis profundos, discusiones estimulantes y una mirada refrescante a tus historias favoritas. Si buscas entretenimiento con valores que resuenan y una comunidad que entiende tu lenguaje espiritual y cultural, Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree es tu destino ideal para una conversación significativa y amena. Hope that serves your purpose well. Would you like any tweaks or additional information included in that?
No, thanks for your help today.
You're welcome. I'm glad I could assist. If you ever need more help or want to dive into another topic, don't hesitate to reach out. enjoy your podcasting journey.
So there you have it. That was a real-time conversation between me and ChatGPT. I must say I was trying this out the other day and it said that it would be willing to co-host the podcast. So I don't know, maybe ChatGPT is less sure of itself today than it was yesterday. I find that interesting. But in any event, that just shows you how advanced these sort of AI tools are becoming right now. That was a real-time conversation, and I love that it pulled up the Iron Giant. That was really interesting. So anyway, I'm just going to put this in here towards the end of the podcast. And so now I hope you enjoy the rest of your regularly scheduled podcast. I'll let you get back to that. And for the record, I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. All right, I promise this is the last interruption. I did tell you that I would let you know how much I ended up cutting out the dead time as the ChatGPT thought about what I'd said and formulated its responses. The original file there was 8 minutes and 52 seconds long, and when I was done editing the dead time out, it ended up being 7 minutes and 41 seconds. So about a minute and 10 seconds worth of stuff cut out in a nearly 9-minute conversation, just to give you an idea of the ratio to ChatGPT's time to think while it's formulating its response. So I think that's pretty neat, pretty interesting. And you guys, the future is here. That is just, that's amazing. And anyway, I'll let you really, now seriously this time, back to your regularly scheduled podcast. We're going to skip our ratings segment because there are lots of interesting AI movies, but we haven't really reviewed any one of them particularly, but there are lots of good TV shows and movies out there. We've mentioned some of them. If some of these sound like they might help you get a grasp on what's going on in our world technologically, go ahead and give them a watch or go give them a listen or a read. We've talked about some of the books and stuff that have done it as well. You can follow me. I'm on Threads at Carl Cranny, trying to get rid of Twitter because that place has become more of a dumpster fire every week. Liz, where can people find you if they'd like to reach out or get in touch?
You can follow my writing and book reviews at lizbusby.com.
Nathaniel, where could people get in touch with you if they wanted to?
I am still on Twitter, to my detriment, at Nathaniel Givens. I am also starting on Threads at Nathaniel.Givens, just my name.
Jeffrey, where could people get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter, a lot of the same philosopher. You can also just email me, jeffrey.thane@gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice or on YouTube. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode via email, social media, or on our website. It really makes our day as podcast hosts to hear from you. Liz, can you tell us what we'll be discussing in our next episode?
Next time, we're going to be discussing The Nightmare Before Christmas, the classic 1993 animated movie about Halloween taking over Christmas. We're going to call this good for our Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas specials, right? I never know when to watch this movie. I could watch it for all three, really. So be ready for that conversation in our next episode.
The question, do you watch this for Halloween or Christmas? Yes. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.